Good morning, everybody. It's so wonderful to see everybody. Chanukah Sameach. It is wonderful to be learning together. I really look forward to this, our Chanukah learning, because it gives us a chance to sort of sink into our Yom Tov in a meaningful way. We have to make sure that when we're learning together, when you come to a new Yom Tov, a new festival, you need to make sure that you come with some new Torah, some new ideas. Just like you, when you come to a Yom Tov, you want to make sure you have a new item of clothing and you feel good about that Yom Tov if you're able to. But then you should certainly come with some new Torah and ideas to feel good about it. So I'd like to share a new idea with you today. The topic is from Sukkot to Chanukah this year and 2,000 years ago. Just some reflections through Torah thought about today. I want to thank Moshe and Paula Weinstein, who are our sponsors this morning. And it's so nice to have a sponsorship for Simcha. That's such a nice reason to be to be celebrating with you as we celebrate your first great grandson, little Judah, to Noah and Nicole, which is wonderful, wonderful, wonderful news. He should be the first of many, Be'ezrat Hashem, in good health. And he himself should be always remembered to have been born at a time of pivoting from dark to light, Be'ezrat Hashem. We'll be a Chanukah, and we'll always think to Klal Yisrael as the time that little Judah is a Yehuda Maccabi for Klal Yisrael as well. Be'ezras Hashem, Mazal Tov, continued nachas. So let's start. Let's start our learning together. Let's start with an old question and perhaps a new answer. This is a very old question, a very famous question, which I'm sure has been asked many, many times, and that is, why is Chanukah 8 nights or 8 days really? Very basic question. After all, if you're going to do the counting of the miracle, really, technically speaking, the miracle really lasted 7 days. Because, yes, they finished the battle, then they lit the candles. The candles should have lit for 1 day, and yet it lasted for 8 days. So the miracle is from day 2 onwards. That's when the miracle really starts, which would have been yesterday, Shabbos. That's when the miracle starts. Day number 1, that's all natural. We don't need 8 days of Chanukah. We just need 7 days of Chanukah. And that's the very, very, very famous question, which is recorded in the Beis Yosef. Rav Yosef Kara asked this question, and there are many answers, so much that there's a sefer called Ner Lameah, which is a book written called A Lamp for the 100, where there are 100 separate answers are given to this particular question. So we're not going to go through all those 100, but I'd like to suggest an answer, which I came across just this year, which I wasn't aware of. And it actually opens up a new theme for us. The answer is based on a very famous Gemara about how we light Chanukah candles. And the Gemara records for us that there are 3 levels of lighting. The basic level of lighting is what's called Ner Ish Ubeisoy. One house has one candle. So if you'd walk past the basic house, you'd see one candle in the window or by the door, and that would be sufficient. Then the Gemara says, but Mahadran, if you the next level up, is where it is Ner Lekol Echad VeEchad, that everybody in the house lights a candle, one candle. So then that would mean to say how many people in the house, that's how many candles you would see by that door or by that window. And then finally the Gemara says, Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin, we hear the two options. So take a look at this first source here, this in the middle of the line. Va Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin, the Gemara says, in the Shabbos Chaf Aleph Mabez, Be'y Shammai Omrim, Yom Rishon Madlik Shmona, Mikan Ve'elach Poiches V'Hoylech. So Beis Shammai would say you go from 8 and downwards. Beis Hillel Omrim Yom Rishon Madlik Achas Mikan Ve'elach Moisif Oilech. And Beis Hillel would say you'd like 1, and then you climatically increase. That's the famous Machlokes. We obviously know which way we do. And the Gemara then tries to insert reasoning into these two opinions. Amar Ula Pligi Ba Trei Amorai Ba Ma'arava. Two sages of the Gemara argued about this in the West, referring to Israel. Okay, so remember they're living in Babylon, so to the west is Israel. Rabbi Yosi bar Oven, Rabbi Yosi ben Zvida bar Zvida, Chad Amar Tamid Beis Shammai Keneged Yomim Nichnasim V'Tamid Beis Hillel Keneged Yomim Hayotzim. So one interpretation of the Machlokes is, do you look at the days that are coming or the days that are leaving? So according to Beis Hillel, I'm looking at every day I've accomplished. So, you know, sort of a notch on the belt. And that's 1 day, that's 2 days, that's 3 days. Whereas Beis Shammai is saying, I'm looking at how many days come. I have 8 days to come, I have 7 days to come, I have 6 days to come. That's the way of interpreting it. And we spent time before in previous years looking at the idea of potential versus actual. The second is where we have it over here. So another interpretation of their machlokes is that we always ascend in Kedusha, so we don't diminish. Right? It would feel sad if you're building up to one candle. and it was so when it comes to when it comes to something which is holy. Beis Hillel says we always build upwards, but Beis Shammai says is that we have another model, and that is Poreachag. Poreachag refers to the bullocks. That's how they usually translate it. Also known as bulls of the festival, referring to Sukkos. And on Sukkos, although all the other korbanos were static in number, when it came to the bulls, they were actually diminishing. So in 13, 12, 10, you had them all up. There's 70. That's those are the bulls, which is why, if you remember, on Sukkos laning, every day is different. Why is it different? Because every day there's a different number of bulls. And just like the bulls, the korbanos diminished, so too the candles diminished. That's how he would model it. So the answer that's suggested is if the model used for Chanukah is the bulls of the Chag, then it wouldn't make sense that Chanukah would also be 8 days like the 7 and 1 day of Sukkos. That's the suggestion, is that somehow Beis Shammai isn't just looking around for patterns. Right? It's not like he's saying, well, let me see if there's any numbers that are, you know, that are moving around, and maybe I can use that as a model. He obviously is saying there's something about Sukkos, which is related to Chanukah. And therefore, I'm going to use a detail of that to, so to speak, use as the template for our creation of Chanukah. That's what seems to be said. And then the question becomes, well, why? Like, what in the world? Where is he coming from? Why should that be so? And it's particularly meaningful this year, particularly haunting this year, because right now we stand at the beginning of Chanukah, and we're now essentially, we are connected very much to Sukkos. Right, we never had a chance to last night actually was the first time I said every year we put our on the end of our Hoshana Rabbah, we put our little bit of nursery on top of one of the bookshelves, you know, and every year, you know, it's busy after Sukkos and you leave them there and it gets dusty and it's like not respectful. And this year I said, this year I'm gonna make sure I put them in the right place and I'm gonna put them away. And then a war happened on Shunet Seres. And so I looked at them at Chanukah and I said, oi, I left my lulav and esrog right there. I didn't have a moment to breathe. None of us had a moment to put our esrogs and lulavs away from Sukkos, because we moved straight from Sukkos to Chanukah, right? That's what it's been. The last 60 days we've been consumed by this war in Israel. It started on Shmini Atzeres, and now here we are at Chanukah. And the question is maybe there is some connection. Can we dig a little deeper? And the truth is there are many connections. This is certainly not the only connection. So take a look at other examples. Then if you flip the page to the Mishnah in Bikurim, the Mishnah in Bikurim talks about when is the parameter of being able to bring Bikurim. Bikurim are the first fruit. When do you start bringing Bikurim? We all know that. That's the easy part. Shavuos, that's why it's called Yom HaBikurim, the day of the first fruit, which makes sense. In Israel, it's like really the spring is really in full blast at that point in time. The fruits are coming into fruition. It's a beautiful time as we enter the summer, coming into this moment of ripeness. So the question is, how long can you bring your Bikurim for? As a farmer, the Mishnah tells us, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Remevi Bikore, Me'atzeres V'ad HaChag. You can bring it from Atzeres, which refers to Shavuos, Ad HaChag, which is Sukkos. Why? Because Sukkos is the Chag HaAsif, the time when you're gathering in, and so that's the end point. Maybe v'kare. Mina Chag v'ad Chanukah, maybe v'enokare. But let's say I find fruit which is still ripening after Sukkos. I'm allowed to bring those first fruit to the Beis HaMikdash and be able to bring it to the Beis HaMikdash, but I don't pronounce. I don't make the pronouncement of Bikurim as recorded in Parshas Kisavai. Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira, Omer, maybe v'kare, you can still do it until Chanukah. So it seems like Chanukah is seen as the extension, we'll call it the tax extension for our Bikurim experience continues to Chanukah, whether it is accompanied with a Kriya or not. That's an observation that's made. But it doesn't stop there. As an example, what is the highest place you can place you can make your Sukkah until? The Mishnah tells us at the beginning of Sukkah, it is 20 Amos high. That is the highest Sukkah that one can have. Whereas the Gemara also tells us in the Mesech HaShabbos, that where is the highest point you can put your menorah is 20 amos high. And now, it hasn't happened to me, there's no other measurement in a Reuven. There may be an argument, but there's no other visual mitzvah which is related to this particular height. Both the Chanukiah and the Schach need to be below 20 amos as well. And there are many such examples of this. So for instance, if you look in Tanakh itself, you'll see many, many different examples of where the connection between Chanukah and Sukkot. Now you say, well, there wasn't Chanukah in the Torah. There wasn't. But if you read, let's say, Parshas Emor, where it talks about the Korbanos, so it goes through with the Parshas Mikra Kodesh in Vayikra Perek Chaf Gimel, towards the end of Parshas Emor. It describes all the festivals and what the Korbanos are brought and what the practices are on those festivals. And it goes through the year. It starts around Pesach time, and then it goes all the way through the year, ends in Sukkot. And what's the immediate paragraph following Sukkot? Is it says, here's how you light the menorah in the Beis Hamikdash. You say, is that interesting? Yeah. The immediate parasha after Sukkot. And now, it makes sense in a lot of ways, because on the one hand, actually, sequentially in the year, there's going to be a day where we're going to light the menorah right after Sukkot. That's sort of the next festival. But it's almost as if the Torah sees that embedded into the notion of Sukkot is lighting this menorah as well. Fascinating. Also, if you look into the Haftorahs, so let's say the Haftorah, when you go to the last day of Sukkot, the second day of Sukkot, is actually quoting Melachim Aleph Perek Ches, which is what? Sorry, Perek Zayin. What is the topic there in Melachim Beis Perek Zayin Ches? Is the dedication of the Beis Hamikdash. That's what's called Chanukas HaMikdash, the dedication of the Mikdash. And it's almost as if it's seen like this is now Chanukah is the Chanukas HaMikdash a second time around. The second Beis Hamikdash is really done at the time of Chanukah. So there's a lot of very interesting parallels that one can learn from this. And the question is what does one make of those parallels? How do we interpret this? So the truth is that the first interpretation is simply historical, right? These observations which are made are not somebody, you know, sort of sucking this out of their thumb. This is not that we don't have a biblical festival. It isn't explicitly mentioned in the Torah, so let's go look for something. It happens to be this is historical. Why? So if you read Sefer Maccabim and you read Sefer HaShmonaim also references, Sefer HaShmonaim is sort of a much more sort of tried to be patterned after Megillas Esther. That's sort of the way it's written. Very short, but the Sefer Maccabim is much more extensive. And in describing Maccabim too, because there were many, many wars that were fought, in the 10th parak of this, the book of Maccabees 2, we're told the following. I'm just going to read the English for this. This is on the next page. It says, and from this the Lord, and from the Lord it was this, to purge the house the same day the nations defiled it, and it was the 25th of the month of Kislev. So first, the Sefer Maccabim points out that when was the Beis Hamikdash taken from Jewish control? Was actually on the 25th of Kislev. So the day they liberated the Beis Hamikdash was the same day in the year that they lost it. That's worthwhile also noting, which is a very interesting point. So Chanukah is the memorial of loss and regaining of the Beis Hamikdash at the same time. That's an interesting point I don't think most people are aware of. Then it goes further and it says, and they celebrated the festival of the Lord for 8 days, like the festival of Sukkot. And they remembered the previous days when they celebrated the festival of Sukkot in the mountains and in the caves, and they went out in the desolation or the wilderness like wild beasts. So they come to the Beis Hamikdash, it's Chanukah time, and they celebrate now the Sukkot. Why? Because where were they on Sukkot? They were in caves, right? They were hiding as in guerrilla warfare from the Greeks' armies. And they took willows of the brook and branches of palm trees, and they sang a song of praise and thanksgiving to the Lord, who gave them the courage and salvation to purify the temple of His holiness. And they sent for a voice in all the cities of Judah to celebrate this festival every year. So what was the first Chanukah really, according to the book of Maccabees? What was it really? It was really Sukkot. Right? Such a fascinating historical point. The first Chanukah was an 8-day celebration of the festival they missed, which was Sukkot. You see, because unlike Pesach, where, you know, you go on your field trips and you just bring matzah with you, when it comes to Sukkot, you know, it's always, you're always thinking, whenever you're going on a Cholamoed trip, you're thinking about some limitation, right? Is it where I'm eating or what I'm eating? So when it comes to Pesach, okay, the what I'm eating, we can figure out. But the where I'm eating is a little more complicated. And so when you are a refugee, or you're fighting guerrilla warfare, hiding in some cave in the middle of Judah and Samaria, at such a point, it becomes a little more complicated to celebrate. So this was not the mitzvah. Hashem did not tell them to celebrate Sukkot on the 25th of Kislev, but this is the time they, so to speak, had this commemoration of that experience as a factor of the fact that they missed this. And in fact, this is picked up on by many midrashim, and as if I take a look at a summary of this in the Aruch HaShulchan, the Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, in his Sefer Codifying Halacha, references this point, and he says this is precisely why Chanukah is as it is. Take a look, reverse a page for a moment. He says, "Va'emes kenu." The truth is, and by the way, this is so why it's so wonderful learning the Aruch HaShulchan, because not only does he summarize all the Rishonim and the Halacha, but he also adds in little like nuggets like this in the middle of the Halacha. So this is in Tav Reish. Where he says, "To be midrash ishas isas shebemneches hamishkan nigmara be'esrim v'chamisha bekislev." We know there's a midrash which tells us that that when they built the Mishkan originally, Moshe Rabbeinu gave the command when. When did Moshe Rabbeinu say that they should build the Mishkan? The day after Yom Kippur, right? He comes down to the Torah, the second luchos on Yom Kippur, after the resolution of the Har Sinai, the golden calf debacle, comes down, gives the command the day after Yom Kippur. There's a very quick fundraising campaign. Ends on the day before Sukkot, for 2 days, and then they start building on Sukkot. That's when they start building the Mishkan. When is the Mishkan completed? On the 25th of Kislev. So it's a very fast building project. But they waited till the first of Nisan. Sheboi Noldu Avos. They felt that was the most appropriate time was in Nisan. Va'Kadosh Baruch Hu Shilem V'Lo Bimei Matisyahu. And our Kadosh Baruch Hu paid him back in the times of the Chashmonaim to rededicate the Mishkan then. The Mikdash then. V'lochen osu kamoi Chanukas HaMishkan shehayu shivas yimei amiluim. And that's why when they rededicated the Mikdash, they made it an 8-day process. 7 days of inauguration. V'yom HaShmini hu gmar hascholas avodas HaMishkan al yedei Aaron uvonov k'mevuar b'Torah. So that's why they did it. It did 7 in 1 day. Like by Yom HaShmini, Parsha Shmini is the 8th day of that inauguration of the Mishkan. So they had an 8-day experience with the rededication of the Mikdash that was missed. V'chen Shlomo HaMelech b'chanucho es habayis k'rissi v'yas Shlomo Sachag shivas yomim v'yom HaShmini atzeres. So and similarly, when we made the dedicated the first place of the Mikdash, it was an 8-day program. And similarly, so that this seems to be the pattern. Ayin Shom v'lochen l'zikaron koru yom tov gazu gam kein Chanukah. They called it a dedication festival. As similar. So the format of dedicating a Mishkan or a Mikdash is an 8-day format, as was done originally by Yom HaShmini. That's Parshas Tetzaveh and Shmini describe the inauguration of the Mishkan. Then there was an inauguration of the Beis Hamikdash. That's in Melachim Zion, Melachim Periches. And then finally, we have it over here again, Chanukah, when they rededicate the second Beis Hamikdash. So it was Mishkan 1, it was Mikdash 1, and really Mikdash 2, which never being rededicated. The odd time, he says, another reason is lazem avua b'sefer chashmonai shal yedei hagzeros botlu oz mila hakriv b'chag hasukos ha'avar uveshmini atzeres ulachen izikaron ze osu shmona yomim Chanukah umimela kesheheru lohem min hashamayim anes shel hadlaka herum sheeskimu al yodom lasos shmona yomim. So here's what they did. They said, because you're going to ask and you say, wait a second, what's this got to do with candles? So this is the way that he describes it, is they know they missed the previous Sukkot because they were fighting. They come to the Beis Hamikdash and they say, this is the time, and they cut down palm fronds and they cut down aravos and they celebrate the Sukkot they missed. And they make it an 8-day of dedication, patterning after the Chanukah, patterning after the Sukkot they missed, and patterning after the dedication of the Beis Hamikdash. And lo and behold, the lamps they lit last for those entire 8 days, no longer. So they take that as a sign from God that what they did was correct. So the lamps, the light, ratifies their decision to make it a Sukkot-esque festival. Is that fascinating? Mm. So then says, Beis Shammai, so when you light like Pareachag. Beis Shammai wasn't saying, I'm just looking for random numbers, ascending or descending. He's saying, this has to, because what Hashem did for us is clearly based on our format, we have to celebrate it as such. So just historically speaking, this is obvious. If we haven't read the history, so if we haven't read Sefer Maccabim and seen this, then we're scratching our heads why there's so many parallels. But if we know this, then it's obvious. The starting point is obvious. The question is what do we make of it. Okay, so now at this point in time, this isn't a full why. This is more like just a note. This is a historical note that this is the case. And the spiritual, so to speak, memo here is that the lamps match The light lasts as long as the festival does, so it is clearly divinely corroborated. But then the question is, so why? We still need to dig in. Why? Why is this the case as well? So there are a number of many suggestions out there. I'd like to just focus on three potential whys. We'll call it a day today. So one idea which is fascinating is, let's go back to Sukkot for a second itself. Why are there the Parei HaChag? Why are there these bulls that are brought on Sukkot? Why are they descending? So if you add up all the bulls, if a descending sequence of 13 downwards, ending after 7, and you add those all up, it's a mathematical equation. What's the number? 70, right? So we all know it. Fascinating, and the Gemara in Sukkot tells us, Sukkot Daf Nunhei Beis tells us very famously that this is Keneged Shivim Umos. This is the 70 nations. So why are we bringing Karbonos for this Shivim Umos? Yes, so it's a place of Tilapol Avim, so we represent them. But to what end? Why are we bringing a Karban? Chag is a time that we need donim al, that we're judged on what?
Water.
So the most basic idea is that we're bringing Karbonos on behalf of every other nation, that they should have water, Mashiva Ruach Amorid HaGeshem, which is essentially the key to economic prosperity. So we're praying on their behalf, we're bringing a crop on their behalf, that there should be economic prosperity in the world. We all win together. When we're doing well, we can make Abraham Accords, right? We're able to share the wealth, and we're part of that tapestry of nations. We bring those karbonos on the chag as well. So that's the way we do it. Which is why the Gemara sort of sarcastically comments is that when they destroyed the Beis Hamikdash, they didn't know what they were destroying, meaning they were puncturing their one of the keys to their success, which was that in the Beis Olamim that we would be sacrificing them. Okay, be it as it may, that's what's said. So why are they diminishing? So there's different ways of interpreting this. The most basic way of interpreting this is that over the course of time, then there's a diminishing of the power of all the nations of the world. And how do we end? Shmini Atzeres, where there's one bull reflecting the relationship Hashem has with the nation of Israel. If you want to be a little more sophisticated, if you read Rav Hirsch in Parshas Emor, it's worthwhile reading. Rav Hirsch points out that actually we start off with Kvasim, which are these lambs. There's 14 lambs, how does it work, and 13 bulls. Okay, so he says there's two sets of 7 and a 7 and a 6. And what happens is the lambs remain constant, so there's two sets of 7 remains a constant, and the bulls go from a 7-6 down to a 7. Interesting, okay? So meaning to say, and so he says it parallels actually the Israel is the two sets of 7, the nations of the world are 7 and a 6, and they, so to speak, only have access to the dimension of 6, and that 6 disappears, so to speak, their reach within this world. And he has a whole thesis about the so to speak, the parallel tracks of power, physical and spiritual power in this world, the diminishing spiritual power of the nations of the world. Very, very fascinating, worthwhile. It's a few-page thesis that Rav Hirsch develops. But be it as it may, whichever way we want to read this, it sounds like the relationship with the rest of the world is diminishing over the course of time, leading to the culmination in history where there's going to be a relationship with one. So Shmini Atzeres is seen at the end of human destiny is going to be where HaKadosh Baruch Hu's relationship with the unique nation remains constant. That's what is seen. Okay, so Beis Shammai says that we're taking that model to Hanukkah because, interestingly enough, Hanukkah was the first time that we were attacked or persecuted, not based on territory per se. Now, it happened to be there was a financial interest. Antiochus has a little bit of trouble with the Romans, and he was not a very good ruler whatsoever, and Jerusalem had money. So there are conflicts. If you read Josephus, he had interest in this, and there were multiple Jewish factions who were willing to give money from the coffers of the Beis HaMikdash for power, right? So the Hellenized Jews and the Sadducees, there was a complicated time. This was not a time of unity, necessarily. But be it as it may, at the same time, this is the persecution over here. It seemed to be that the Greeks were totally fine with us being not unique. You know, meaning as long as you perform in our gymnasium, and as long as you're willing to conform to Greek society, speak proper universal language, be able to write with footnotes, and be able to think logically in the way that we've now developed, then that's fine. And this is the first time we're being persecuted as ideologically rather than physically or for other interests, which means to say that what we're defending now, what Beis Shammai is essentially saying is our defense is we're not simply defending our nationhood as existence or territory. We're defending our culture. That's what it is, because that was what was persecuted. Bris Milah, Yom Tov, all those things were ways the Greek saying is don't be different. Just like the rest of the world, just Hellenize and you'll be fine. Here's the toga and join the party. And the Israel said, no, thank you. And so therefore, in a certain sense, it's commemorating when they chose what festival should this look like. It looked like the festival of remembering Shmini Atzeres, of remembering that our relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is unique. There's nothing else. There's no other nation which is going to be like this at the end of the day, in the end of the day as well. And that's perhaps what Beis Shammah was saying. So rather than thinking of Beis Shammah as an anticlimactic description of, wow, Zos Chanukah, one candle, what he's saying is, no, that's history. There will be one nation that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a relationship with. And by the way, it's born out in today's day and age. I mean, if you think about it for a second, who cares about the war in Ukraine today? Really? I mean, yes, the person who left out their yellow and blue flag from, 2 years ago, that's about it. I mean, the civilian casualties there have been horrific. Horrific. Does anybody know the count? Do you know how many journalists were killed in Ukraine? But yet, when there's an Al Jazeera journalist who's in the middle of a battlefront, and there's a questionable bullet, it becomes months of prolonged, agonized investigation. In the first month against Russia and Ukraine, there were 23 journalists killed in battle. Nobody said boo. Nobody cared an iota that there were journalists who were killed then. When the United Forces were taking over Mosul from ISIS, right? Was anybody sending snapshots of the destroyed buildings? Nothing. Did anybody protest the death of Palestinians at the hands of the Syrians and the hands of the Lebanese, of which there were thousands? Nobody even knows about that. That was a footnote at the back of the newspaper because it clearly wasn't about the Palestinians' right or determination to succeed. So you see something unique, which is as much as everybody else wants to say the Jews are not special, by focusing on us, they're telling us we are very special. And everything is different when it comes to Jews. And apparently statements about genocide don't apply the same way. It requires context for one nation than everybody else. So when you see that, it comes back to sort of that Shmini Atzeres, but in a negative form, which is, you are unique. And we're being reminded that we're unique, but not the right kind of unique, because it would be nice to be the unique where it's unique as the moral nation, a nation who has an army with such a code of conduct, a nation who's so careful even about their enemies. That would be that's where we're aiming for. We're not there yet. But clearly the rest of the world, in their attempt to remove differentiation, has differentiated us in a way which I think this Hanukkah we're feeling very much is happening as well. Another possibility I noticed was in the Sfas Emes. The Sfas Emes actually is two is the following observation. So where it came from. He makes the following observation on the top of page 6, where he says, without doing the whole thing, he just says, B'mnei bino yimei shmona kavu shirum renonim. He says, De'isa b'gemara taima de Beis Shammah neged parei achag, nire de tala'oi hayomim b'chag asukos ki mistama b'oysa ashona hitzlichu b'nei Yisrael b'chodesh tishrei b'tshuva v'tfila ki kol ashona tolo b'ksiv v'chasim ashal tishrei. So what his observation is that why was it that they succeeded on Hanukkah? It was because they succeeded in Tishrei. When is the end of the process of judgment? Yisukos, right? Hoshana Rabba, Yom HaChisom. So which means to say they knew already that Sukkos, that there's something was happening this year, they would succeed. And that was why Sukkos and Hanukkah were connected, because they realized their spiritual efforts were going to bear fruit in physical efforts that were about to come this year, which is the connection between one and the other.
There's a very famous symbolism in that.
How's that?
They say we're going to battle, you might say, against Umos HaOlam and Yom Narayim. How do you know who emerges the victor? The one who holds the trophy. And the
interesting.
The represents the trophy of victory.
Very interesting.
So that brings that back in.
Very interesting. So that's sort of the sense of spiritual success, which will lead to physical success. I remember this major, so very, very fascinating. This is what he says now. And he says, in fact, he goes on further to say, that there was the, there was an element of sort of spiritual justification. They felt that there's something that happened this year. They felt right. They felt correct about this. In the same way that Sarat Silom Me'aleihem, which is a verse used to describe the shadow has disappeared, which is related to the Meraglim and related to Hoshana Rabbah, where somebody, so to speak, his spiritual power has disappeared, and now there's going to be a collapse. They understood this was happening over Sukkot. This particular observation happens to be a heavy observation this year around, because I'll tell you the ruminations I have. Is, you know, we've been saying Avinu Malkeinu now, and never before has it been so meaningful, because so many of those verses where it's the Gezeras Kashos and Machshavos Sanenu, Batavashos Sanenu, all those things, and then on that tail end, all sacrifice and blood and children and all those things, that's all in Avinu Malkeinu. Chamal Olalenu V'tapenu, V'harugim Hashem Kochecha, those are all there. But you know what kills me? Is we were saying that before this all happened. We said this to our Aseres Yemei Teshuva, and obviously we didn't think about it enough. Obviously we didn't even conceive that this would be possible. And so clearly we're just automating ourselves as we went through, and clearly to me I feel the pain of our Yom HaNoraim not having been strong enough. That to me is so to speak the reflection, the foil of this. And you may say, don't be pessimistic. You know what, maybe this saved a further catastrophe. There was other things that didn't happen. People were still saved. And yes, Be'ezra Hashem, and I'm sure Atulos had an incredible impact. But still, there was a gap. There was an opening in the fence. And so this particular observation here is the connection between where we are now in the thicket of things and where it started, the pristine of things. So this was a time where things... Does everybody remember the conversations on the night of Shmini Atzeres? Right, we sat in the sukkah. It was a beautiful night, and I remember our conversations at the table. And I feel guilty for those conversations. Like I go backwards. I say, as we were talking at whatever it was, our meal went to 11 o'clock at night. As we were talking in our meal, things were starting in Israel. And I say to myself, like, how could we be having such regular conversations at such a critical time? But we didn't know. We had no idea. But the point is that going back, it was such a pure time compared to what was about to unfold. And what the Sosemis is saying is a connection between then and now, and what we're doing then and now. I'd like to frame it on the positive side, because this is a very heavy point. There is an observation I saw yesterday written in the Bas Ayin. Bas Ayin makes the observation, not clear in the sources, because I found it after we prepared for this year. But he says actually quoting the parasha of Shavua, where he says yesterday in Parashas Vayeshev. He describes how Yehuda is presented with this, as a judge of the city, is presented with this complicated problem that his daughter-in-law, who's supposed to be waiting to marry his son, which is in a certain state, a state of bondage, of marriage, of semi-marriage, an element of Yibum, Shomeres Yabam, and yet she is pregnant. So that's a real problem. So he says, it's 3 months later, and they say that your daughter-in-law has been immoral and is now pregnant to that immorality. So the Bas Ayin says, this is not just that story. It's referring to all of us. Because what happens is we come to HaKadosh Baruch Hu at the beginning of Tishrei. And we say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we're so pure, we're so wonderful, we're so everything. And then Vayikim Shalosh Chadashim, and like, let the year unwind a little bit. And now here we are 3 months later from Tishrei, at the beginning of Teves, right? So we have Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev. We're at the beginning of this time now. And all those promises and all those aspirations and all those hopes of who we would be, not exactly what we wanted to be. And then, and in fact, not only is it that there were a few mistakes, but inei hara liznunim. We looked at our HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that, you know, we've made mistakes which are not just, you know, things which we can wash off. We've sort of become very attached to the identity that we didn't want to be. And so it says, what does Yehuda say? So speak, Yud being the metaphor for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Yud Kei Vav Kei, says, Hotzi Ovis Tisarev, like, listen, you said to me, you came in front of me on Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, and you said, this is going to be the year, and pure, and wonderful, and so on. And now look at you, around Chanukah time, three months later, here you are, and you're not behaving like you promised you would behave. So, Hotzi Ovis Tisarev, because it's just a quid pro quo. You knew the rules of conduct, you transgressed them. So there's a consequence. So what does she say? Who does this belong to? Because that's who caused me this. And he goes on, now again, this is very Hasidic. But so the psilim refers to the wicks, and the chosemes refers to that pacha shemen that was found in the Beis Hamikdash, and the matter refers to, again, you're going out on limit, is the gematria of kli, which is the vessel which holds it. So what do we say? HaKadosh Baruch Hu, here's what we have. We're at Hanukkah. We're 3 months later. It's the middle of darkness. It's not as we planned. There's mistakes. There's all the issues. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you put us into this complicated world, but we're trying to light that light. We're trying to hold on to that dream of who we wanted to be when things were all great. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Tzad Kamimen, you're right. I gave you a very difficult landscape, and I understand why it was so difficult. I see you still trying to light the lights. I see you still trying to connect to the Tishrei experience. It's not Kabi many. So he rereads the story as the story of all of us, the story of humanity. That, by the way, is the much more positive reflection of the Sfas Emes' observation. Right? The Sfas Emes was saying that what happens now is a reflection of what happened then. How good we did then is how successful we'll be now. He's saying, no, sometimes it's not that. There's no parity. It's the lack of parity which we're trying to draw, that nurse, that little one seed. And I think, you know, we've seen at the beginning so many people are so connected, and it's more complicated. It's fraying a little bit sometimes. No. We still want to be connected. We're still trying hard. We're still learning from that experience that we saw as well. And finally, one last observation, we'll close because we have to close, is the following observation. Is that, again, another observation made by the father of the Sfas Emes, in the last source, and he says, Adoni Avi, Zakeni, I think, Mori Rabbi, Zeran Roch, Heroli Remes, the Mishnah Michag, Hanukkah, maybe Vaino Kore, the Loy Omar ad Kofi Kislav. Lirmoz, it teaches us where the Bikurim goes until Hanukkah. Lirmoz, Kinimshach, Hatzer, Haras, Hachag, Ad Hanukkah. The light of Sukkot continues to Hanukkah as well. What does that mean? Lufizanira, Ki is Hadchus, Hashana, Shivatish, and Nimshach, Ad Ata, Velochem, maybe Oid Bikurim. This is still considered the beginning of the year. The year stopped beginning now. The last leaves are on the trees now. That's the end of the beginning. This is the beginning of the education, the end of the beginning of the education of the year. And then he goes on to say, the Gemara tells us in Sukkah that when I had these celebrations of the around the Simchas Beis HaShoev, what do they do? They'd have these huge lamps, and these lamps would shine throughout Yerushalayim. It says there was no courtyard in all of Jerusalem that wasn't lit up by the beautiful lamps of the Simchas Beis HaShoev, and everyone would converge upon the Beis HaMikdash, and then these parties that went all the way through the night, and these beautiful things. In a certain sense, he says that light continues. Why are we lighting now? We're lighting as a continuation. We're trying to sort of extend that light which shone everywhere. We're now shining it outwards further as well. It's so interesting, which is why it has to do with sight, right? The circle can't be too high. You need to be aware of it. So Hanukkah is where you need to make other people aware of the miracle. In a certain sense, it seems like Hanukkah is the extension of shining that light. But think about it from the following perspective. How do they celebrate Hanukkah the first year after this 1 year anniversary of Hanukkah? How do they celebrate? Where do they do it? The Beis Hamikdash. They didn't have Hanukkahs in their houses. They didn't the Beis Hamikdash. Why? Because that's where they succeeded, and they carried on doing that. Hanukkah was celebrated in the Beis Hamikdash because that's where the miracle happened. When did the Hanukkah emerge as we have it? When the Beis Hamikdash recessed from being the place to be able to celebrate it. So our houses, in a certain sense, are the practical continuum of what should have been in the Beis Hamikdash. That's exactly what's happening. Hanukkah is the domesticated form of the celebrations that would happen in the Beis Hamikdash itself. The grandness now down to a human level as well. And that's what it is. And the light isn't as big and it doesn't shine as far, but it's all of us. All of us are that army. It's not just one centralized government and one centralized policy. It's all of us spreading our lights in the way that we can, and that's what we've been seeing in the last little time as well. So just some perspectives of sort of trying to bridge this time that we've experienced, where it started, where it's continued, and hopefully as it will end, as our light will succeed. Bezra Hashem. Thank you so much, everybody, for coming. Have a Chanukah Sameach. Please join us upstairs for Tehillim.